was perusing, I got introduced to Facebook mom groups when my daughter was a newborn, and I came across an article by Dr. Laura Markham, who writes, has written a number of parenting books and writes the website ahaparenting.com. Is anyone familiar with AHA Parenting? Okay. So she put out a call that she was interested in training clinicians to become certified peaceful parenting coaches. And I'm still really proud to say I was one of only 15 people chosen worldwide to train with Dr. Markham. I trained with someone who was from Beirut, several people in the UK, and then all over the US. So since I received that training, I give talks like this. I teach workshops in San Diego, where I live. And then I also, the bulk of my work is private coaching with clients. So I want to talk to you about what peaceful parenting is, how we can better equip ourselves with tools and suggestions and tips. I'm going to finish today, and you're going to have some actionable things that you can do, some things that you can leave here and put into place with your family. And what I think is really important, and this speaks to Jill's point, that these things I'm going to talk about today are important in every single kind of relationship. I had a husband recently email me and said, "So I'm trying all the things that you told me with the kids, and it's really helping. And don't tell Amanda, but I'm also doing them with her. And it's really helping." And he was so excited, like this was a new novel approach. I said, yeah, these ideas work for every relationship. So sometimes when people hear what is peaceful parenting, you know, they think that it means permissive parenting or your child makes all of the decisions. And those things couldn't be further from the truth. I like to boil down peaceful parenting into two words, kind and firm. Because the truth is that all children need boundaries, limits, and to know where the line is. They need to know that you are their big person. They count on that. Children who don't have that, who have permissive parents, are prone to anxiety because children feel really insecure living in the world. It's our job to be their big person and take care of them. So really what peaceful parenting is, it's kind and firm. It's focused on connection, empathy, and really meeting your child where they are. So what the research tells us is that peaceful parenting raises kids who have high emotional intelligence. And we'll talk a bit more about that later, but that is an important key. A lot of research tells us that emotional intelligence is more important than IQ. We all know that person who's really, really, really smart, but you really don't want to end up sitting next to them at your table because they're kind of awkward. That person struggles with emotional intelligence. And so giving our children these tools when they're young helps them grow up to be a person who can go in the world and have all sorts of kind of relationships. Children who are raised this way also have higher levels of self-discipline. They're able to be more responsible and they're more successful. Go to the next slide. So Dr. Laura Markham's model of peaceful parenting boils down to three things. So I'm going to tell you them now, and then we're going to go through them individually in more detail. So the first is that we, the parents, focus on self-regulation. The second is that we focus on connecting with our child. And lastly, that we work as a coach versus controller. So when it comes to self-regulation, next slide, please. So I want to see a show of hands of everyone who is awesome at self-regulation. Okay. So this is about typical. Sometimes I'll get one person in the back kind of shyly raising her hand. So you'll notice that I didn't raise my hand either. Self-regulation, I always say, is my life's work. You know, I grew up in that loud, angry, abusive household, and there was one volume, and it was screaming. So whether or not I have learned over the years that that's not a great way to communicate, that's still in me. And so I have to work on a regular basis to bring the calm, not the chaos, to stay peaceful, and to remember to communicate not only with my daughter, but with everyone else in the world with kindness and respect. So really, the reason that self-regulation is so important is that, one, when we are dealing with distress, we have two choices. We can either join the distress or we can meet with calm. And meeting with calm will always bring things down. The second reason that self-regulation is important, and I think this is actually the most important piece, is that we are constantly modeling for our children. They may not do what we say, but they will always do what we do. Every one of you, I'm certain, has an example of a time that your child has said or done something that they heard from you. Some of those stories are really funny, and some of them are a little cringeworthy, right? So they are always paying attention to us. And so the more that we are practicing regulating our emotions, the more they're picking up. Oh gosh, this isn't an emergency. I can, you know, spill things on the floor and it's okay because I can just clean it up. So there are lots of ways to improve your self-regulation. Mindfulness, you know, for the past 10 or 12 years, it's a buzzword, right? Everywhere you turn around, people are talking about mindfulness. And really, mindfulness is any time that you're really in the moment. So right now, it's 9:59, it's October 22nd, we're sitting here, being where you are, which is really hard. Raise your hand if you tend to think about the past or the future. Right? It's human. So practicing mindfulness, there's different ways to do it. One of the easiest and most cliched ways is to focus on your breathing. What research tells us is that studies are mixed. It's either 3 or 5 slow, deep breaths on a regular basis can retrain your brain to be less reactive. So I'd like us all together to take 3 slow, deep breaths. We're going to breathe in through your nose, and then you're going to breathe out through your mouth. The first thing I notice when I do that is that my shoulders drop down. I don't always realize they're up here hanging out. They drop down. You guys were already really quiet when we started, but even you could tell, even in the room gets more settled. So there's a great app on the iPhone called Breathe. And you can also do this if you have an Apple Watch. I'm sure there's lots of options, but I like the iPhone app Breathe. And what it does is it goes off at certain intervals. Mine goes off once an hour. It sets off a little ding. And when I hear that, I stop whatever it is I'm doing, and I take 3 slow, deep breaths. In our family, everyone participates. Whoever hears it, it's usually my daughter, says, "Breathe, break." And everyone stops and takes 3 slow, deep breaths. We've been doing this since my daughter was a baby, and she, at 6 years old, will tell me, "I need to take a breathe break," when she's starting to get upset. Now, that is a tool that I only learned in my 30s. So the fact that I'm giving her that tool at a young age will change her life. So implementing something as simple as breathing. Another thing that's really wonderful is meditation. Can I see a show of hands of anyone who meditates? Can I see a show of hands of people who think meditation is too hard? Yeah, your heads are going everywhere, right? My head too. So what I love to recommend are guided meditations. There's the Calm app, the Headspace app. There are tens of thousands of free guided meditations on YouTube. What the research tells us that if you meditate every day for 8 weeks, you will physically shrink the size of your amygdala. Now, the amygdala is the part of your brain that tells you fight, flight, or freeze. So every day for 8 weeks. There's no time limit. You know, I do a loving kindness meditation every day. It's 6 minutes long. It's research. It's you can give yourself that gift of 6 minutes a day. Another thing that's really helpful for self-regulation are mantras. On the pens that I passed around, there's a mantra I love, connect before you correct. My personal mantra that I use is this is not an emergency. Because after growing up in that chaotic household I grew up in, my amygdala is big and very reactive. It likes to tell me that things are an emergency when they are not. And so what happens is that I take some deep breaths and I repeat to myself, sometimes kind of like a crazy person, this is not an emergency, this is not an emergency, this is not an emergency. Because I got to talk myself down. Mantras are like affirmations. They feel silly sometimes when you're starting out and you think this can't possibly help, but they do. Some other mantras that I really like are he or she is having a hard time, not giving me a hard time. It's such a helpful reminder because we often take our children's behavior personally when the truth is they're just acting like a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5-year-old. I love choose love or choose peace. There's not a situation that you can encounter that choosing love or peace is going to make worse. It's always going to help. Does anyone have any mantras they use? Okay. What I recommend is you can think about some of the ones I've shared. You can also go on Pinterest. I found that to be the best place and search parenting mantras. There are hundreds of them. And just like affirmations, you have to choose one that feels right to you. I have a lot of parents who come back to me and say they use this is not an emergency. What that also can help us do is retrain our thinking, because so often we're trained to be reactive over small things. You know, we have a lot of conversations in our house, and my daughter says, I know it's not an emergency, but it sure feels like one. And so then we get to talk about that. What does that feel like? What is an actual emergency? Because the truth is, barring, you know, freak accidents, there are very few actual emergencies that happen in our day-to-day life. And so remembering that is incredibly helpful. Anger and yelling is something that a lot of parents come to me about. No one raises their hand in the middle of a talk or a class and says, I yell at my kids and I feel great about it. Those people always come to me on the side and say, oh, can I talk to you for a second? So what we know and what the research tells us is that yelling is not effective communication. Oftentimes we feel like our children only respond when we yell. And that's because we're scaring them. There was a great research study that interviewed young children. It talked about how they felt when they were being yelled at. If you think about it, you're talking to a 3-year-old who's, you know, down here, I think, right? It's been a while. And you're a grown-up big person. The look on your face when you're yelling, the sound of your voice, the tone of your voice. You know, in that study, they asked kids, and kids said, you know, I feel like I'm going to be hurt. I feel really scared. So yelling is something that we can improve on, and there's some very tangible ways. First of all, practicing the breathing, the meditation, those things will help soothe that reactivity. I also love what I call a yellibacy chart, celibacy from yelling. So I like it because it's funny. So what it is that you have a little chart and you say to your child, Mama really wants to stop yelling. It's not, you don't deserve to be yelled at. No one does. So I'm going to work on this. And then at the end of the day, you're going to tell me if I earned a sticker, if I had a respectful voice with you. Now, this works for kids who are about 2 and up. And here's why it works. Setting an intention is always helpful. Certainly, if you set that intention with prayer and ask God to help, which is something I have to do every day, not with yelling, but just with parenting, because it's hard. And so you set that intention. You ask God for help. Accountability is also helpful. It doesn't matter if you're accountable to me as your coach or you're accountable to your three-year-old. I hear stories again and again from parents who say, I was about to lose it and I was kind of getting up there and my daughter said to me, Mama, don't lose your sticker. And she said, I started crying, which was probably what I actually needed to do in the first place, right? I discharged those emotions in a healthier way and felt so proud, like, gosh, this is really working. I have a template for a Yellow Bussy chart that you can email me. My email's on the card, and I'm happy to send it to you. Lastly, the importance of self-care. Now, I'm going to start a campaign to change away from self-care, because I think people hear self-care and they think pedicures and massages, which you should absolutely do because they're wonderful. But really, it's about making an investment in your mental health and sanity. And that can look like all sorts of different things. For some people, it's saying no to that yet another activity. It's saying, no, I actually can't volunteer for that. It's not packing your day so full that you feel like you don't get to sit down until 9 o'clock at night. It's not good for anyone, and it's certainly not good for the family. One of the things that I hear time and time again is that parenthood is loud, right? There's a lot of noise, particularly even if you just have an infant, lots of noise. And depending on your personality, that can be really tricky. So one of the things, I was just talking with a mom in coaching yesterday, and she said, I think part of my problem is that I was an only child, and I was used to being alone a lot. And now I have these two boys who never stop talking and never stop jumping on each other, and I just want some peace and quiet. And so one of the things I recommended to her is that she do, this is something I personally do, is I sit in silence for at least 15 minutes a day. Sometimes that's just going to pick up my daughter from school. I turn off my podcast, I turn off the music, and I just sit in silence. Sometimes I get home in the evening, and if I'm in the car by myself, I just sit in the driveway like a creeper with the car off and just sit there. And my husband will say, I heard you pull up. That peace, just that little bit of peace makes a huge difference. I was always in trouble my whole life for talking too much. I have all these great report cards. Will not control her excessive talking. And one, Mrs. Gauzy, that's how I make a living. So there. And two, I have my comeuppance because my daughter is the exact same way. She talks constantly. She talks in her sleep. Give me some peace. So that 15 minutes a day is really important. The other piece is finding something that you enjoy that you can do for an hour a week without your children. So not counting today, raise your hand if you've done something on your own that you enjoy without your children for an hour in the last week. Okay. So not that many, maybe about a quarter. Having that space where you're not a mom, obviously you're still a mom, but where you're not doing mom work and you're not, you know, running errands. Sometimes moms will say, well, I went grocery shopping by myself. Does that count? Nope. I mean, maybe if you're weird and grocery shopping brings you joy. Really, it's about finding that place where you're not a mom, you're not a wife, you're just you. Where I'm just Lisa. What my thing is I do yoga because it gives me breathing, mantra, meditation, all in 1 hour. So I'm like, I'm gonna do it all. So finding that thing, whatever it is for you, all the better if it's some physical exercise because of what that does to our brains and, of course, our bodies. So finding that space, because we can't give from an empty bucket. You know, we can't give to our children who need a lot from us if we don't have anything. It's like they say when you get on the plane, you have to put on your own oxygen mask first. And I reiterate, before we move on to connection that self-care is not selfish. It's really mandatory. I have a mom who's, she keeps coming for coaching, but she really likes to argue with all of my suggestions. She's a delight. And I say to her, well, something must be working because you're here again. And she said, this hour to myself, I think it's BS. And I said, wait, try it for 1 week and then report back. Can you do it for 1 week? She's like, okay. So she goes across the street and sits at the Starbucks. She doesn't even get anything. She just sits on the patio and reads a book. And after 4 days, after she had done it the first time, she emailed me, and I could just sense her sheepish tone. She said, so I think my best afternoon as a mom this week was after I went to the Starbucks for an hour and read my book. And so I guess you're right. I did a little dance. I was so excited because that, having that space, it does make such a huge difference. Okay, so now we're going to talk about connection on the next slide. All right, so connection is essential to all relationships. We are hardwired for connection. Being able to feel that time with another person. And we know what that's like with all of our relationships. You have relationships, you know, you may have friendships where you hang out and maybe you go shopping or you get a cup of coffee, but you're not sharing your deep, dark secrets, right? You're just sort of visiting. And then you have those relationships where after you leave time with that person, you feel good, you feel lighter, you feel happier. It's because of that connection. We're all looking to be connected to one another. And our children are biologically wired to be connected to us and to follow after us. If you've ever gotten to watch a mama duck with their baby ducks following after them, like in a row, that's because they're wired, because they know that mama duck is going to keep them alive. It's going to feed them. It's going to keep them safe. And it's the same with our children. But to strengthen that bond and that desire for them to follow after us, they have to feel safe, they have to feel connected, and they have to feel that unconditional love. So I want everyone to close their eyes for a minute and think about the last time you really felt connected to your child. That's why we became parents. No one became parents to get someone into a car seat or convince them to put pants on to leave the house. We became parents for that incredible relationship that we have with these people that we created with God. And so sometimes that means that that moment of connection comes after you've been playing together or having a good laugh or just sitting and snuggling on the couch, whatever that looks like. So developing that connection and strengthening that is an essential component to strengthening not only the relationship, but what happens is that connection creates cooperation. So when we are more connected to our children, they're more likely to cooperate with us. Because as you know, with all relationships, you want to do for people that you feel close to. It's our natural instinct. And so being able to have that influence creates those beautiful moments of parenthood. So next we'll talk about coaching on the next slide. So emotion coaching is a term that was defined by John Gottman, who's primarily known for his research in marriage. But he has also written a wonderful book called Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. And he coined the term emotion coaching. Now, this is something that probably a lot of you do, but you just didn't know there was a term for it. What emotion coaching is helping children to be able to identify and express their feelings. Brené Brown, who is probably the only famous social worker and one of my personal heroes, recently talks about some research that says to have emotional intelligence, the average adult has to be able to identify 30 emotions. But the average American can identify 3. sad, mad, and happy. If you think about even just one of those, think about mad. There's a whole range in there, right? There's annoyed, irritated, frustrated, upset, angry. My daughter's favorite, furious. And then rage, right? So there's a whole group that just fit into that one thing. And most of us, unless you are a social worker, unless you have done a lot of therapy where they made you pull out that feelings chart and identify them, most of us don't know those. And so then we can't teach them to our children. So there's lots of ways to, for you yourself to get more comfortable with feelings. You can go on Google and look up a feelings chart. There's all sorts of great ones. They have the little faces making the feelings with the word that goes with it. I'm a huge fan of Todd Parr's feelings flashcards. Todd Parr is a children's book author who you'd recognize him right away. His illustrations are bright and bold and colorful, and it's all his books are handwritten, so they're really neat. He makes these feelings flashcards. You can get them for under $20 on Amazon, and they really run the gamut of feelings, and you can play games with them. I recently took them into my daughter's first grade class, and we played charades. I would show the kiddo the feeling, and they would act it out, and all the rest of the kids would answer it. You can do that in your own family. Being able to expose your kids to these different emotions and help them identify them. So my daughter came home from school. Who has school-aged children? Anyone? Okay. So you know that the social politics start young. I did not know. I do not remember kindergarten being so challenging socially. And so my daughter came home and she said, Ara said she never wants to be my friend again. And I said, I spent the whole day with you guys on the field trip. What happened in the last half hour of school? Very dramatic at age 6. And she said, I don't know. She just said I had to go away and she didn't want to talk to me ever again. I said, oh, it sounds really hard. You must have felt left out. She said, I did feel left out. I said, you feel really alone. I did feel alone. I felt like I just didn't have a friend anymore, and I was all by myself. I'm like, yeah, that's isolating. So that's an example of emotion coaching. I'm listening to her. I'm empathizing. I'm reflecting. I'm using feeling words to help her identify those feelings she's having with a word to use. The key to emotion coaching is empathy. And I mentioned Brené Brown. You can get on YouTube and look up Brené Brown Empathy. She has, you can go down the rabbit hole and learn a lot. But she has a short video that describes the difference between empathy and sympathy, which is a place that a lot of people get confused. So empathy is not, I'm sorry that happened to you. Empathy is feeling what that person is feeling. Now, you know, my friendships are pretty stable. I'm 42. None of my friends have recently said to me they never wanted to speak to me again and didn't want to be friends. But I have felt disappointed. I have felt left out. I have felt, you know, that feeling of walking into a new place and being like, oh my gosh, I don't know anyone in this whole room. So that's where I can empathize. I can empathize with the feelings. And sometimes when we're dealing with young children, you know, 2 and 3 year olds, their worlds are very small. And so they often will become very upset about something that for us with our adult lenses on, we don't see as a big deal. And so it can be hard to give empathy about the fact that someone looked at their toy. It's a thing. So what we can do is say, oh gosh, you seem really upset that so-and-so looked at your toy. I wonder if you're afraid he might take it, which is usually what's going on. And so with young children, you have to be a bit of a detective and help them. You know, I love the phrase, I wonder. I wonder if you're feeling really sad because daddy isn't home from work yet. You know, that's helping them to identify those feelings. Or I notice that you're sitting all by yourself and not playing with your friends. I wonder what happened. And helping them to start to develop that connection and that language about the feelings they're feeling. So the emotional backpack is a concept of Dr. Markham's that children and adults are all wearing a metaphorical backpack. And anything that we don't deal with, if you were raised in a family where you were told not to cry, all of those feelings get put in that backpack. And the truth is that feelings only go away when they're felt. So any feelings that you have not expressed or not dealt with are just hanging out in your backpack. Now, depending on your life, it may take a while for it to get full. But when you're 2 or 3 or 4, your backpack gets full quickly because there are constantly slights that we as adults don't realize. Someone looked at your toy. Someone grabbed your toy. Your mom held another little boy's hand. You have a new sibling and feel completely replaced. All of those things happen and fill up that emotional backpack. So there are two ways to empty that emotional backpack, and that's with laughter and crying. A lot of people, like myself, grew up in a household where I was told not to cry, that crying was seen as a weakness, that I was overly sensitive. And I hear that a lot from people. And so being comfortable with their children crying and expressing their emotions can be really hard for them. I'm happy to send you, there's some great research that talks about the importance of crying and how it has physical, emotional, and physiological benefits for our bodies and our brains, as well as our emotional state. So having those tears, we all know what it feels like after you have a good cry. And laughter. Laughter changes. When you laugh with someone, you can both get a burst of oxytocin, which is that bonding hormone. It reduces your heart rate. It reduces your blood pressure. Laughter is so important. And the thing about kids is they're really easy to make laugh, right? Especially young children. If you just make a funny face at them, they'll start laughing. So you've got a really easy audience. You don't need to be a comedian. But being playful and silly to get that laughter is a way to empty that backpack. Okay, next. So I come from a place of working at prevention. Certainly, there are important ways that we can address and manage meltdowns, upsets, you know, moving, new babies, all of those things. But what I recommend and what the research says is that if we do things in prevention, we will have less meltdowns. The ones we have will be shorter. And we will have improved and increased connection. We talked a lot about connection. And these are some tools that you can use in your day-to-day life with your family to improve and maintain that connection. And the first is welcoming feelings. As I just mentioned, if you grew up in a house where that wasn't okay, I encourage you to do some reading, do a little research, look at why feeling our feelings is important. If you are uncomfortable with your feelings, you're going to be uncomfortable with your children's feelings. So do the work that you have to do. You know, I always say that parenting is a self-improvement project in disguise. No one told me when I became a parent that I was gonna have to look at all my stuff in a whole new way, because my daughter is a mirror to me, and I see myself in her all the time. And I notice my reactions. And those old ideas that I have worked on for many years before I even became a parent still pop up. Like, oh, why is she crying? Oh, this is ridiculous. Nope, that's not true. This is a big deal because she's 6. So getting comfortable with your own feelings, whether that means, you know, calling me and doing some sessions with me, whether that means going to therapy, whether that means, you know, speaking to your pastor, using prayer and meditation, but to really develop that sense of comfort that feelings are okay, that we welcome feelings. We limit behavior, but we welcome feelings. So next is empathy 24/7. Which, of course, is a stretch, right? No one can show empathy 24/7. I like to use it as a mantra on those hard days. I'm sort of saying in my head, empathy 24/7. Oh, gosh, that's really hard. That the plate you really wanted is dirty. And of course, like in that other part of my brain, I'm like, are you kidding me? But when you're two, that plate is very important. So finding a way to practice empathy. Here's the thing. This is the thing that dad was talking about in his message to me. He was talking about the importance of empathy with his wife. And that leading with empathy is a practice that would benefit all of our relationships. And that it takes practice. If you weren't raised that way, if that's not the way you normally talked, if you are not a social worker and don't feel comfortable leading with, oh gosh, that sounds like a hard day. I'm so glad you're home. You must be wiped out. Right? So often we go into fix-it mode, especially if we're real helpers and we want to help them fix whatever is going on. But we all know how good it feels when someone just gets us and gets what we're experiencing and is like, yes, I am so exhausted. So practicing that empathy. We talked already about laughter and how important laughter is. Let me see a show of hands of anyone who roughhouses with their kids. Nice. So roughhousing is one of the really underutilized parenting tools. On YouTube, you can watch a short TED Talk, by TED Talk standards, it's about 12 minutes, called The Art of Roughhousing. And it is by the author of a book by the same name, a very nice to look at male pediatrician. I feel like I just have to say that. And he talks about the science behind roughhousing. He shares why roughhousing, which not as many moms, usually in a group this size, I have like 7 or 8 moms raise their hand, so it's great. And why it helps. You know, all you have to do is go to the zoo and watch the monkeys or the apes, and they're all roughhousing with their kids. It's nature. So what roughhousing does, and I'm not talking WWF, like figure four, headlock, body slam, that's all I can remember. I'm talking about physical play that elicits laughter. As I mentioned, young kids are really easy, so it's very easy to get them to laugh and be silly. On my Facebook page, Becoming Peaceful, which I invite you to follow, I post daily parenting inspiration, articles, suggestions. In fact, today I'm doing a giveaway because I just hit 10,000 likes, so you can be entered to win a free parenting coaching session. But on there, on the video section, there are 2 videos of roughhousing games, because so many moms in particular came to me and said, I don't want to roughhouse, my husband does that. And so one of them is where I make my daughter into a pizza. I lay her down. I pretend that she's the dough. I knead the dough. I throw her up in the air, which has gotten much harder lately because she weighs 50 pounds now. I throw her up in the air, and then I put the sauce on. And, of course, it's always something silly. You know, I put blueberry sauce, and I put Brussels sprouts, and she's just laughing and saying, you don't put Brussels sprouts on pizza. And then I say, hey, pizzas don't talk. And she... She laughs hysterically, put her in the oven, cut her up, and then pretend to eat her. I have been making her into a pizza for 6 years, and it is still hilarious to her because they're an easy audience. The other video is her pushing my husband off the bed. This is something that for 5 years she did every morning. She would whisper to me. She would come into our bed and say, Mama, take Daddy's covers off. Except she is just now learning to whisper, so it was more like, Mama, take Daddy's covers off. I would take the covers off, and she would start to push him off the bed. And he would resist and say, you can't push me off the bed. I'm too strong. And she would say, I can do it. And there's laughter and silliness. And then eventually she pushes him off the bed, and she's like, didn't get old, 5 years for her. So those are 2 examples I have on my website, becomingpeaceful.com, a collection of 12 demonstration videos of these different roughhousing games. So if it's not in your forte and you're not really sure, start with those two videos on my Facebook page. And if you need more ideas, you can purchase that webinar. Finding a way to incorporate roughhousing into your daily life with your children is one of the things that I promise you will make a difference. It will be transformative. What the research says is to laugh with your kids for 10 minutes a day. Now, obviously, you're not going to set a timer and say, okay, let's start laughing. But what you can do is you can find ways to incorporate playfulness into things. So often, we're stuck in a power struggle with our kids about something that nobody wants to do, right? Nobody wants to brush their teeth. Apologies to any dentists. But no one's excited about it, especially if you're three. And so oftentimes parents will come to me and say, every night's a battle. And so I'll say, well, why don't you infuse some playfulness? You know, what about if you say, you brush my teeth and then I'll brush yours, which is a no-fail way to get kids excited because they think it's hilarious to brush their parents' teeth. I have other parents who say, you know, oh, I saw something in your mouth. I need you to open up, you know, then they're being silly. There's all sorts of ways to infuse playfulness into your daily life with your kids, and you can meet that 10 minutes of laughter, but you can also feel good about that relationship. It feels good to laugh with someone. So next is special time. So when people come to my workshop, and I talk about special time, and I tell them that if you do this every day for the next 2 weeks, and your relationship with your children doesn't change dramatically, I will give you your money back. Because I believe so strongly in this tool. What special time is it's daily one-on-one time with your child for 15 minutes. So what you do is you give it a name. The formality is a big part of it. In our house, it's Ruby Mama special time. And we set the timer for 15 minutes, and I say, okay, it's Ruby Mama special time. What do you want to do? And she gets to choose. She gets to choose what we want to play. No screens, no books, just play. Inevitably, she picks something I have zero interest in doing. Playing is not my strong suit. I was the kid who grew up reading books in the corner while everyone else was playing or doing their thing. And so I have to push myself out of my comfort zone. But that's what the timer is for. The timer's for us. Because if you had to tell me I had to play Mama Bear and Baby Bear, where the closet is our den, for an hour, I would run out of here screaming. It's not even a walk-in closet, guys. But I can do it for 15 minutes, and I can really do it. Like, I can get into being Mama Bear, and I can commit to that. And so what I tell parents is that even if you're the parent who loves playing, even if you're the parent who spends a lot of time on the floor with their kids and having fun, there is something different about special time. The truth is, in today's world, we are all usually doing at least two things at once because there's so much to do. You know, maybe we're making dinner, the phone is ringing, the door is ringing, we've got other children to deal with. That one-on-one, completely uninterrupted, all of my attention is on you, fills that cup. What parents tell me again and again is that when they start doing special time, their kids start to ask for it. When are we going to do special time today, Mama? When are we going to do special time? Oh, can I have my special time? Ideally, both parents do special time with their kids every day. Families who have multiple children, obviously, you know, you've got five kids, it's a little more difficult. That's something I spend a lot of time in coaching with. They're like, well, I want to do special time, but help me figure out how to do it. You know, nap times are a great time when older kids are in school. Once your kids are older, they can be on their own for 15 minutes. And again, parents come back to me and say, it's made such a huge difference, and I don't understand why. And I can tell you that I don't understand either. It is different. A few weeks ago, I took my daughter to one of those trampoline parks. You know the ones I'm talking about. And for an hour and a half, we jumped together. I went down that, there's an enormous slide at the one by our house, which is like, feels like a death trap. I went down this slide. I nearly killed myself on the obstacle course. I didn't have my phone. I played with her the entire time. And we got home, and 20 minutes later, she said, "Mama, when are we gonna do special time?" Huh? Because it's different. I don't know why. I've asked her since she's older. I said, "What's different about that versus what we just did?" She said, "It's just different." So finding that time, making that time, making that a priority is absolutely something that will transform your relationship. Routines are very important. Children need to know what's coming next. Lots of adults need to know what I need to know what's coming next. And so finding ways to have routines around your life and around daily activities. A dad I work with, his did drop off and pick up, and every morning his four-year-old is having a hard time. And I said, make a little ritual that you guys do together that only you know about. So they developed this secret handshake that has like 15 steps. I could not begin to explain it to you. And after 2 days, they would do the handshake and he would scoot off into class. And then dad picks them up and they do it again. It's that moment of connection and bonding before they move on to the next thing. It's not always magic like that. It doesn't always happen on the second day. But those things, those rituals and routines are huge. And then lastly, our scheduled meltdowns. So we talked about the emotional backpack and how it gets really full. So if you are paying attention, you'll see when your child is about to have a meltdown. They're perhaps more rigid, more demanding, less cooperative, just sort of like on edge, the same way you feel when you need to have a good cry. And so we can help them by offering the time and space to give them that meltdown. Now, some people say, gosh, this sounds mean. So I always like to offer that how I give myself a scheduled meltdown. Every week on Thursday, I watch This Is Us. And I bawl my eyes out for like the whole hour. Your mileage may vary, but I find it very moving. And I'm not just crying about whatever wonderful thing or terrible thing happened to the Pearson family. I'm crying about all the stuff that happened that week that I haven't dealt with. And I'm someone who loves feelings and loves to feel my feelings, but stuff piles up, right? And so letting that all out. So what we can do for our kiddos is give them that opportunity. So here's the example I like to share. Your kiddo's having a hard time. You know that if you can push through and maybe you'll go to Costco after you've already gone to two other places, but you sense it's coming, right? Like, oh, they're going to melt down. The last place to have a meltdown is in Costco. It feels so loud. So instead you go home, and maybe ordinarily you wouldn't care if they had a popsicle, but that day, you know they need that little push. They need that This Is Us. So you say, you know what, sweetie, I know you really want to have a popsicle, but not today. And then it's the floodgates open. You know when your child has emptied their emotional backpack, because one minute they're crying and really upset, and the next minute they're like, let's play trains. And you're like, what just happened? It's because they got it all out. So these tools of preventative maintenance are really key. I stand here and tell you that I do all of these things in my family. I am a woman of faith and integrity, and I would feel like a real hypocrite if I was like, do these things, but I'm not going to. And what I can tell you is that they work. Next slide. So in summation, we focus on ourselves, our self-regulation, finding ways to increase our ability to bring calm versus chaos. We focus on connection using the tools of preventative maintenance and that ever-important tool of empathy. And lastly, that we coach our children through life versus controlling. Thank you so much for your time.